You're listening to Wake Up Tucson. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Wake Up Tucson, ladies and gentlemen. Ben Bueller Garcia, BBG, Sean McCluskey, Colonel Chaos.
Yeah, you know, it happens. I haven't caused much chaos lately,
though. Emphasis on the chaos. Well, we're about to cause some chaos here, Sean. There's an interesting, when Betsy talked to us about running for office and whatnot, last time I was on, I encouraged people to put their hat in the ring for the Kozachik seat. That's pretty well, that cake's already baked, so you missed out. But there is another opportunity for you. The incumbent running for constable in Justice Precinct 9 was bounced off the ballot by a petition signature challenge. Now, he was the only candidate on the ballot, which means there will be no candidates for the position. It pays $67,000 a year. You just have to get yourself on the ballot as a write-in candidate by June 1st. So if anyone's looking for a decent-paying government job, there you go. There's an opportunity for you.
Now, you have to know that a JP9 voter, Maria Lourdes Escalante, sounds like she ran before, or is entrenched in the Democratic Party. So a little bit about that constable. That constable is George Camacho. He ran against Newspaper Boy last time.
He is the incumbent.
He is. Yeah, okay. I helped him last time he was running because he was running against Newspaper Boy, and I couldn't stand Newspaper Boy and Randall. And so I helped George, and George got on the ballot last time. He filed 211 more signatures than he needed, but some of them were out of district, whatnot, and, you know, he fell into that trap. So you and I talked about that. We talk about this for decades now. It's if you're going to get signatures, you got to verify them. You got to put them through the e-verify. You have to vet them. You have to double check them, and you have to have 25% more than you need. Otherwise, stuff like this happens. And this was Democrat on Democrat hate, which is exciting because you don't always get that.
I try to go on the record saying hate is never exciting. Okay, that's my position.
Well, when parties going after their own, that's when you got to pay attention to it. So what did George do to just upset the hell out of the left so badly that they came after him?
I have no idea.
Nobody. He wasn't very liked going into it. He wasn't the chosen one. He wasn't the favorite child. So when he won, now if they see an opportunity to get rid of him, they got rid of him. I liked him as a constable. He always did everything great and right by me. Apparently, according to the Sentinel article, there were a couple of flaws in his
performance.
I was going to say work performance, and that's a good way to put it. The unfortunate event of the U of A professor, he didn't serve the paperwork to the gentleman that ended that way badly. So, you know, that's the one thing. It comes down to signatures. You got to get your signatures. If you look at the congressional race, you've got it's going to be Wynn versus Ciscomani because both of the libertarians were booted off. They both realized they didn't have enough signatures, and they willfully, by their own,
They withdrew
on their own after they were told they're going to get sued. They didn't have enough money to go to court, so they just came off the ballot.
Now, as I understand it, the challenge period is closed in all the races now.
Correct.
So this will be the last kind of shakeup we see. And I got to tell you, that's one of those jobs you couldn't pay me enough to do. Border Patrol is one of them, plumbers the other. But constable, that's a tough, you know, and basically they're serving eviction notices, summons, those sorts of things. Generally, if a constable shows up at your front door, it's not a good day. So, God bless the men and women that do that. Jeffrey on the line gave us a call, 790-2040, former Tuffy the Toro.
Good morning from the Golfing's Corridor of Safe Drivers. I have a couple of suggestions for cool places in Tucson.
I like it.
Yeah.
And based upon our conversation over Vero's, Matt would appreciate this because we were talking about High Corbett Field and some nostalgia, but Tucson Sign Museum, it's a great nostalgia in terms of former signs and stuff like that. And also for nostalgia, downtown, it's not a restaurant, believe it or not, but there's an arcade place, actually. And another blast from the past, Little Anthony's Diner with the 50s. And in regard to the A Mountain situation, probably Conover is going to disregard the Palestinian ones that painted the A Mountain, but she's going to find out who repainted it white. She's going to press charges, and then she's probably going to press charges on the police officers who wanted to press charges against those who were violating against them. So everybody have a great day. This is from former Tuffy Toro, and have a great day.
You too, sir. Sounds Thanks good. For giving us a call.
Yeah, Jeffrey, to your point, there's another arcade on E, 7th Street.
Pinball?
7th Street and 6th. 7th Street.
Oh.
Just west of 4th.
Yep. Right there, by the bike shop.
Oh, and the name of it is escaping me, but...
I thought it was the pinball arcade.
Yeah, it's a pinball arcade. Yeah.
Right there on the side street. You can't miss it.
Hey, Jeffrey, do you know if they still have the regular weekly car shows out there at Little Anthony's? Because that's kind of cool,
yes,
too.
Yes, they do, and they are completely awesome. And they actually had one several weeks ago at Jim Click, at O'Reilly Chevrolet, and it was awesome. They had a whole bunch of food vendors and live music. It was pretty cool.
And I tell you what.
Matt told me about the pinball place because now I can bring my CD and listen to either Elton John's version or the Who version of Pinball Wizard.
Yeah, it's D&D Pinball. I'm just looking here. It says it's temporarily closed. I don't know what temporarily closed means. So,
shocked.
Somebody ran out of quarters, maybe.
Thank you.
Let's just hope it's that. Yeah, and by the way, that Little Anthony's, there's no charge. You just bring down your car, and you'll see some cool hot rods. I remember I was out there once, and this guy had a 1970 lime green Chevy Vega. And, you know, would not be at the top of the list of my classic cars, but he loved that car, and he was proud of it, and God bless him. He brought it out to show it off, and so, hey, you know.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. You get to look under the hood too, you know. So
true.
And some of these are really antique cars too. So that's awesome.
I tell you what, I miss being able to look under the hood and recognize something
or know what to do.
Yeah.
Now you'll go, okay, fine, mechanic. How you doing?
Okay.
All right. Have a great day.
Thank you, Jeffrey. You have a great weekend, and thanks for calling Wake Up Tucson. Folks, 790-2040. We're looking for suggestions for cool things to do in Tucson in the summertime when it's hot. One of my other favorites, if you haven't been to the Arizona Historical Society Museum there on 2nd Street and Park Avenue, again, right off the main riot gate, amazing stuff. They've got like one of the most beautiful collections of Spanish colonial silver, some of Wyatt Earp's guns. Just a really, really cool place to spend a cool afternoon. And then, of course, you can always eat at all those wonderful General Ben's, which was that our first brewery in Tucson? Do you know, Sean? It's pretty close to it.
I know it's a family-owned business or an employee-owned business.
Yeah.
Which is always nice.
Oh, and I think that the head dude down there is a Marine. It was still the same guy.
Yep.
There you go.
You know, I remember when it was a house over on Tyndall. Now it's grown up a bit, but it was a fun place.
Dang, you're old.
Still a fun place.
Going through the list of people who didn't or got challenged on the ballot, to be on the ballot, Constable was the most heated and contentious race. Like every race that somebody sued somebody else.
Something was going on there. Definitely.
It's Constable's the most desired position to be in. So. Very interesting. Very interesting. I mean, Constable up by me, Anton Chisholm, he got removed by the ballot. So now
he did?
Yeah. I just read it. So now John Camarano, who I win either way. If I got Anton, I won. If I got John, I win. John's an ex-TPD officer. He's ex-SWAT. If his kid's not on TPD, he has his partner's kid is in Marana. His ex-other partner's kid is in Marana. Another partner's kid's in TPD. So... he's a little older, but I'm going to call him not older. I'm going to call him well-seasoned and knows what he's doing. Mm. He's Billy Badass. I mean, he's like 6'4", just
can
fit
as a
fiddle.
Can you say that on the air?
I think he just did.
He just did, okay.
So
it's true, though. I mean, you can find
Billy
me
Badass
later, but
is
it's
on
true.
The phone right now, so he's calling to defend himself. So just to reset the folks who may be new to the show, new to the game here, you know of dealing with constables in your line of work.
Yeah.
And one of the main duties of constables is evictions. And there's a process, and some constables want to play maybe the social worker, and some constables understand that it's a danger fraught proposition. And you can be compassionate, but you also have to do the job right.
You have to be firm and compassionate. Yeah. And you have to also follow the rule of the law. Now, Kristen Randall would make her own laws and she'd make her own rules and she wouldn't file the judge's decision. And she'd let people stay. I'm so glad she's gone. And she would go up without a gun and she would debate people. This one guy we did an eviction together and I don't do a lot of them, but this one, I'll never forget this because this guy was cracked the hell out and she is debating with him and she's maybe 745 pounds. Nothing against her statue, but this guy's like 195 pounds cracked out. I mean, 3 days earlier, the cops had to been called to the house because his girlfriend was rolling around in the 103-degree dirt, naked, because they were cracked out. But she wanted to have a conversation with this person, like, rationally. And he's, like, spitting on her and yelling at her, and then that's when she backed up, and finally we got the cops over there. But, I mean, it's a tough job.
Yeah, no
and
question.
You need somebody who... John fits it perfectly because he's got the training, he's got the wherewithal, he's got the knowledge, and he knows what the hell he's doing. And that's what we're looking for. We want somebody. I want to come home safe.
Right, right.
I mean, that's, I want to come home in one piece. I want the constables to make it home alive,
go,
too.
Go home to your families. Ladies and gentlemen, BBG, Sean McCluskey sitting in for Christy Simone. Feel free to give us a call, 790-2040. We'll be talking housing affordability coming up at 7:30. Welcome back to Wake Up Tucson, ladies and gentlemen. Ben Buehler-Garcia, BBG, Sean McCluskey sitting in for Christy Simone. Sean, you recognize that, don't you?
Oh, a little bit. Just a little bit.
Do you know all the words?
No. Not I. Well, maybe.
I do.
I'm probably not going to sing it, though.
So we're coming up on permanent change of station season for our military family, which also means it's change of command season. And I know last summer I went to, gosh, probably maybe 30 changes of command out there at Davis Mountain Air Force Base. And it's always kind of a bittersweet thing. I mean, you're happy somebody's moving on to their next command. You're welcoming a new family, a new leader to that squadron or that unit. So it's kind of cool. But at the end of every change of command, of course, we sing the Air Force song. So I've got those words down pretty well.
Yep. But it's neat when they change command because it's, you know, you get out with the old and with the new, but it's all pretty much the same. You know, there's little difference of philosophy changes, but overall, the whole systematic thing stays the same.
Well, yeah, and that's necessary.
Oh, sure.
There has to be that consistency. So, yeah, I tell you, the ones that really get me are the retirement ceremonies. And I can't remember the exact language, but they read the order from the commander-in-chief or the general, whoever it is, saying, okay, basically, you're done, bye-bye.
Yeah.
And then they put a little thing on the wife, and it's over. And that's kind of, I mean, I'm glad they put in their 20 years or their 30 years, whatever it is, but still kind of hard to, for me, it's hard to watch.
On to the next chapter of your life.
Speaking of next chapters of life, again, I want to encourage anybody who's interested. We got a great job opening for you, Constable, Justice Precinct 9.
Seats wide open, write-in candidate who gets the most write-in votes wins.
Do you know, there was a situation recently where they were having to pay for their own bulletproof vests and whatnot. Did that ever get resolved? I mean, to me, that's the if you hire me to do a job, at least give me the basic equipment to do it.
What's the clothing allowance? So you have to figure that part out first, because they're going to look at it and say, okay, well, I can't buy a pair of boots if I buy a vest. I can't buy shoes or I can't buy pants if I buy a vest. Again, you want to go home to your family. What's the most important thing? Buy the vest.
Well, yeah, but wouldn't you think you'd be able to give... There should be enough money for your pants and your shoes and your vest.
I would imagine, but I don't set the budget.
Do they issue them weapons, or that's on them too?
I don't know, but I know that I think all but two current constables carry.
I would not go out there unarmed, to be honest with you.
I have a constable that works in the city of Tucson, and he normally stays in the city of Tucson. He had to come out with me in Picture Rocks, and he was out there. Thankfully, the house was vacant, but it's on an acre. He's out there in the middle of the backyard, just walking around, no weapon, no nothing. Didn't knock on the door. Didn't announce himself. I'm like, you're going to get shot out in Picture Rocks. You're not supposed to do that. You couldn't do that in my house either. But I mean, if you went in my backyard, my Great Danes are going to eat you.
Our next guest is actually arriving in the studio, and I think he's looking at us saying, "What did I get myself into?" Well, don't worry, John. We'll change horses midstream. So again, I encourage folks. You know, we do have elections coming up. All the challenges are done, so we pretty much know who's going to be on the ballot. There's some critical races in my mind. The Supervisor District 3 race to replace Sharon Bronson, who stepped down. That race is going to be decided in the primary.
Absolutely.
So if you're an independent voter, don't forget that you can request a ballot for either a Republican or a Democrat primary. I encourage you to pull a ballot for that Democrat primary, because that's a hugely important race.
Board of Supervisor District 1, Steve Spain versus Rex Scott, to see if Spain can get out of his own way and raise some money and actually take that this time. Didn't fare very well, and it's a repeat of the last time they did this 4 years ago, so let's see if it changes. It's got to change, otherwise we're doomed as a county.
I tell you, I'm a nerd this way, so I like going and looking at the campaign finance reports. And what was really interesting to me, the race for the county attorneys, Jetty versus incumbent Conover, those numbers are pretty close. I think that race is a toss-up right now.
On that one, you know, again, it's sometimes you get the Democrats finally waking up and they say, oh, my God, I can't keep this person in there because our county and our town's falling apart around us and I live here, so I need to maintain something. And Jetty is the guy to maintain that law and order, if you will.
And I don't know, is the county attorney going to be way down on the ballot?
Oh, it's what?
Down by the constables?
Yes, just above them, I think.
So I tell you, folks, that is another huge, people don't think very much about what the county attorney does, but that's another huge race here in Southern Arizona. And once again, there's only two Democrats on the ballot. That race will be decided in the primary. There's no Republican candidate in that mix. So I encourage you to get your ballot. And I'm an old-fashioned guy, Sean. I like to actually go and drop
physically
it.
Go in and vote.
Yeah. I mean, the way I look at it, you could solve two problems right now nationwide with one stroke of a pen. One, any questions about election integrity, if we all actually went down there and filled out our paper ballot and dropped it in there on election day. And number two, the nationwide obesity epidemic. If people actually get off their butts and walk somewhere and do something, you might burn a few calories.
There you go.
It's my dream. Let me have it.
I like it. LD-17. You got Wadsack versus the Leech. Former incumbent, once upon a time elected Vince Leach. Money there is rather interesting. I think they're very close in money, or is Leach just running away with it?
No, he's not running. From what I can tell, he's got maybe about another 20,000 more, but he had carryover money. So, you know, that might explain that. And he's done pretty good. He raised about 20 grand in the first quarter, according to the reports. And then there will be, whoever comes out of that primary will face a Democrat in the general election. And then on the House side in 17, you've got a very well-funded Democrat will face one of Cory Maguire or Rachel Jones.
It'll be a three-way.
Yeah, well, and for two
will win,
right.
Yeah.
So somebody's going to go home sad in that of those three candidates. So that will be interesting. And from my perspective, that the conservative folks have got a razor-thin margin in the House and the Senate up there at the legislature. So long story short is, folks, I'd be happy to share with you my recommendations, but the main thing is you got to get out and vote. You just have to do it.
17's important because 17 has an 8-point Republican lead or edge, if you will.
In registration.
But Wadsack only won by 1 or 2 points last time because she upset the apple cart, if you will. We'll see what happens in the House race because the two there, Maguire and what's the other one's name?
Rachel Jones.
Thank you. I forget Jones's name all the time. Those two, if they can somehow come together and look normal against the Democrat, they'll maintain their seats. But man, some of the things they do up there is just bizarre.
Did you just say come and look normal?
They need to look normal. Well, they need to stop touting their AR-15s around the Capitol and that kind of thing. I mean, you gotta act, you know, with a little bit of common sense.
I tell you what, there was a couple of years ago, there's somebody that decided to show their support for the Second Amendment by marching around in front of an elementary school with their long guns, and that, needless to say, was about as popular as an ex-girlfriend at a wedding. So,
then the race of all races, Pima County Sheriff.
Absolutely. That's, boy, you talk about
it's a six-way melee.
Kerfuffle. Yeah, we'll see what happens. Hey, we got just a couple minutes for the break, but Brushfire, Sean gave us a call. Brushfire, you've got some ideas for summer fun in Tucson. And don't say Breakers Water Park.
I'm going no. My girlfriend was down here. We did kind of a loop. We went down to the Titan Missile Museum, which is pretty relevant right now. It's a great tour, and it's fascinating for, but you know, local people, we miss out. You know, Pima Air and Space Museum. We did Titan, and then from there we just shot across. I think it's Sal Rita Road, and went down and did the wine tour.
Oh,
down
nice.
In Elgin, we went to the Elgin Distillery, the original one, which is Sonoyta Vineyards, the original guy, and then ended up at Flying Leap and did a nighttime $500 bottle of bourbon tour down there, and went to Steakout. And it's
that's
all
a good
here.
steak restaurant.
Oh, best!
Yeah,
best in that county.
Okay, Brushfire. Thanks for giving us a call,
have
ladies.
Have a great day.
You too. Ladies and gentlemen, BBG, Sean McCluskey sitting in for Christy Simone. When we come back, we'll be chatting with John Ward about basically what goes into making the sausage when it comes to housing here in Southern Arizona. Stick around. You're not going to want to miss it. Welcome back to Wake Up Tucson, ladies and gentlemen. Ben Bueller Garcia, BBG, Captain Chaos, Colonel Chaos.
Sean McCluskey, what's going on? That's well, me.
How? Forgive me, but how was the Billy Joel, the Nylon Curtain? How is that on American Warrior Radio playlist, Matt?
Because it's called Goodnight Saigon.
Well, there you go. I consider so.
Now Chris, you know.
Chris DeSimone, man. He's a step ahead of all of us.
You know, part of...
Even on his day off.
Part of News Talk Radio is providing education so you can make better decisions out there. We're very fortunate to have John Ward joining us today. John, welcome to your first appearance ever on Wake Up Tucson. Maybe your last.
Thanks, Ben. Good morning.
Now, tell us, I want to talk about... I want to inform people out there because we are... Like a lot of places in the country right now, we're in the middle of a housing affordability crisis. So I want to distinguish between housing affordability and affordable housing. We're talking about market rate, whether you know people can afford to get a roof over their heads. And you're, I consider, an expert in this field. So just real quick, go over your background, all the years you've been involved at some point or another in this kind of thing.
Sure. How long is this segment?
As long as you need.
So I started in this business really as a child. My dad and my uncle were speculative developers, so I got exposure to it at a very young age. Went to engineering school, got a degree in civil engineering, started my career out as a professional engineer. And then about 2002, I got recruited into the home building business. I've worked for several different builders in the Tucson market, did one little stint in the Austin market, Central Texas, and then realized I love Tucson, came back to Tucson, and refocused on housing for a period of time. So I've been buying, entitling, and developing land in Tucson for about 25 years now.
Okay. And so you have, and I've heard your, you and I cross paths through the Southern Arizona Home Builders Association on occasion, and you make an, my frustration, John, is I'm down there lobbying and working the elected officials, is the disconnect between their professed desire to have more housing affordability, and then they do things like they pass an EV ordinance. We're looking now at they're examining. Now, in fairness, it's statutory required, but they're looking at the impact fees. And there's all this, I think you use the phrase, there's this death of a thousand cuts that people don't realize. And they just think that the, you know, the developers and the landlords like Sean are just these evil, greedy business people. But there's so much more to it. And are we, I guess my direct question to you would be, are we reaching... In certain jurisdictions, Southern Arizona, are we reaching a breaking point where decision makers in private development companies somewhere in New York, Boston, wherever, are saying, nope, we're going to walk away, and why?
Yeah, that's a great point. I want to back up a little bit and say, you know, the home building industry in Tucson has changed over the last few decades. We used to be predominantly local capital investment. Home builders were local home builders. In the 90s, you started seeing the resurgence of national home builders coming into the market. And I think right now in Tucson, about 80% of all new homes that are built come from a national home builder business. And the fundamental point of that is, where does the capital come from? The investment capital. When the local home builders were raising capital for projects in the 70s and 80s, they were talking to local bankers. And so you had that that connectivity between the financial institutions and the political arena. And, you know, there was a comfort level due to relationships. But now we're bringing money into Arizona from Los Angeles, Miami, Boston, Detroit to, you know, and we're in competition with sister or peer communities. You know, your Albuquerque's, your Salt Lake City's, you know, you go to the Southeast, you know, there are communities that are thriving that are like-sized to Tucson, but they're thriving because they are a safe place to invest capital.
And expound upon that, because you use an example, John, of a stoplight, a red, green, yellow. And I think a lot of the civilians out there don't understand that there's a lot that goes into these national builders making a decision about whether they're going to put their new homes in your hometown or someplace in the Southeast.
Yeah, for sure. So any land acquisition or development effort, whether it's home building or commercial development, starts with a pro forma and a due diligence package. It's a research project to determine if the project's viable. And most people, when we think of due diligence, we think of things like geotechnical engineering, environmental engineering, making sure the land is safe, making sure zoning compliance is acceptable. What most people don't recognize, and I would say most elected officials don't recognize, is the municipality gets rated in most due diligence packages. It's not so much a detailed investigation of the municipal behavior, but it's more of a just what is the ease of development? What is the predictability of the development cycle? What is the timing of the development cycle? And so when I'm talking to electeds or the higher ranking staff members in the municipalities, I like to use the red, yellow, green light comparison. If you're a red from a municipality ease of development perspective, that money's not going to come to Tucson because we're in competition to bring that money in. But a green makes it a safe play.
And what are some of the factors that go into that? Is it bond rating? Is it political atmosphere? Is it whether we have enough cops or not, or all the above?
It's really relative to the entitlement and the engineering perspective of the project. How easy is it to get through a review process for a set of grading plans? Can you safely assume that it's going to be two review cycles and you can be approved? Or does the municipality have a history of five or six reviews to get to approval? And from an entitlement perspective, zoning, if you have a project that's rezoning, that can be an 18-month process. Well, at what points in time do you get a level of certainty that you're going to be successful with that rezoning? Or do you not find out until you're 18 months in and you've spent a couple $100,000 in the process only to find out that somebody changed their mind politically and you can't get the approval you need?
And you just plus your money's tied up for that whole period of time.
Yeah, yeah.
And the interest you're paying on that money, I would guess.
You're paying interest on that money. It gets allocated. The minute you get an approval to go forward with the project, the money gets allocated. So it's maybe not spent, but it's not available for investment somewhere else.
Yeah, it's spoken for, so it's allocated, and you can't do anything with it. Tucson's got to be almost always like red-yellow. Comparative to just surrounding areas, say Sal Rita, say the county, or even Marana or Oral Valley for development.
I'm not sure I'd put Tucson in a red today. There was a season, maybe pre-COVID, that there were some struggles with Tucson. We didn't have a stable history of director of planning and development services in the city, and that was a rough season because. You didn't have that leadership of staff who were reviewing our plans. Tucson's trending in the right direction from that perspective.
It's good to hear.
Yeah.
It's good to hear. I mean, I expected you to say it was going to be in red. So anything above red's good for me.
Yeah.
Well, I think, and kudos, trending in the right direction is a compliment. We're not where, at least from my client's perspective, we're not where we want to be yet, but we're headed in the right direction. You specialize in land acquisition, John. Just a practical civilian knucklehead question. Again, within the city limits proper, are we running out of land? I mean, is there enough acreage large enough for your traditional single family, or are people having to change up their product?
That's a great question. And to be fair, there's still land available, but the easy stuff's gone. Everything that remains that's vacant and ready to or possible development is tough. It's got to be rezoned, or it sits in a floodplain. The market dynamics in the area, submarket criteria has shifted and changed. So I really think within the city of Tucson, absent of strong annexation efforts, we're looking at redevelopment of properties, the big box stores that are vacant now. If we could ease the zoning efforts to change those back down to residential zoning, we could start reestablishing, strong home ownership in the core of Tucson.
I know there's a bill sort of creeping through the legislature right now that would allow for more of what they call the missing middle housing, the you know, the townhomes, the condos. And my understanding, it was almost impossible for a while to build townhomes in Tucson. And I don't know why. Was it because of setback requirements, or maybe there just wasn't a demand for that product? Or any insights on that, John?
Yeah, it's funny. Within Tucson, I don't think there's ever been a disdain politically for townhomes. But you do run into issues with, will a townhome make sense if your impact fees are going to be the same as the impact fees for, say, a traditional single family detached house? You know, there is an adjustment to impact fees for, you know, traditional multifamily, but there's not for townhomes or casitas or similar.
Yeah. You nailed it. Yeah, absolutely nailed it. You rolled right into my next question. It's not land acquisition, but the impact fees, if you're doing an ADU or you want to do, like you said, multifamily, you have to pay for each water meter.
Exactly.
And that is, what, $4,500 or $4,800 per water meter? It keeps changing, so forgive me, I don't get the number right. But it doesn't matter if you build a 9,000-square-foot house or if you build a 900-square-foot house, those impact fees are the same.
Pretty much, yeah.
So affordability, you got to build something smaller, but your costs to get it started are the same if you build a mega mansion. It doesn't make any damn sense, but that's the politics of it.
Yeah.
I tell you, if I want to come back, I want to talk more about this. This is very, very helpful, and people need to understand this. You know, it's easy enough to go out there and pound the podium and say we need more housing affordability, but until you understand all the things that go into this, and, you know, Sean and John just made a perfect example about, you know, there needs to be some kind of a recognition of the impact fee related to the square footage or the type of project. So BBG, Sean McCluskey sitting in for Christy Simone. We're very pleased to have John Ward joining us. Give us a call, 790-2040. We'll be right back.
Theme from Band of Brothers on the American Warrior playlist put together by Christy Simone for Sean and Ben.
Welcome back to Wake Up Tucson, ladies and gentlemen. Ben Buehler-Garcia, Sean McCluskey. We're joined by John Ward. We're talking about housing affordability. That right there, that theme from Band of Brothers, probably my favorite. When you talk about military movies or series, that's at the top of my list. I've probably watched that series easily 20 times. I could cite the lines better than some of the actors. But anyway, thanks out there. If you're listening, Chris, wherever you are, thank you for that American Warrior Radio playlist this morning. Folks, we're talking about what goes into housing affordability, things that most of us don't think about, but impact the price of a home. We're talking with John Ward, decades of experience, and you're a young guy, don't get me wrong. You started early. John, you and I had it's the little stuff. It's the death of a thousand cuts. And, you know, I also have clients that are in the multifamily housing business. And the city of Tucson, about a year ago, passed an ordinance that requires all new multifamily housing to install certain levels of EV charging stations.
Yeah.
And that should be up to the builders, the managers of those apartments know what their clients want. They'll respond accordingly, depending on what the need is. Being told to do it, we're now hearing that there's some national insurance companies that are either significantly raising the cost of insurance or not issuing insurance because of the fire hazards. And it's this unintended consequences that just really gets my goat here in Tucson. It's like, how do we get to more housing affordability if you're raising the cost of building housing? And by the way, the builders they're not eating that. They're going to pass it on to the tenants or the home buyers, right? I mean, what am I missing here?
Ben, you hit the nail on the head. When the regulatory community has an idea to regulate an industry like home building, I want to give them the benefit of the doubt and say I don't ever think it's, you know, with mal intentions. I think their intentions are good. But what they don't understand is the home building industry, for one, studies the market more than any other industry I can think of. Maybe the automobile industry studies the market more. They know what the buying community wants. So when you mandate something needs to be put in, even if it's only going to add the cost, say $1,000 to the cost of the house, there's no proof in that regulatory requirement that the market's willing to pay that extra $1,000. And so then you've got to back up and say, do the regulators really think that the builders are eating that extra $1,000 cost? And the answer is no. That's a direct pass on to the consumer. Most builders are traded on Wall Street. They have requirements to hit, return on investments with the Wall Street brokers, and so any additional cost just goes straight to the home buyer, and that just starts to elevate. And that's where affordable housing and housing affordability start to differentiate.
Right. Right. You and I were in a meeting together talking about the low, the low impact development ordinance, and the idea being that they want to shift the way we design our landscaping in order to capture more stormwater, with the goal being reducing the amount of potable water that's used on landscaping, which is a laudable goal. We live in the desert. We're all for that. But in the discussion, it was pretty, and these were with the experts, the city officials and whatnot. And it was interesting to me, John, that right off the bat, it was you and a bunch of other technical people and just all these ideas that started coming out. It was a great discussion. But apart from, and again, kudos to the staff down there, Dan Bursick and the other folks who said, okay, let's have this discussion. We want to hear what you all have to say. And you came up with something that, as a non-technical expert, to me, it was like a simple, like, duh, thing that we could change that we do in Tucson, they don't do in Phoenix, that could save costs. And explain that to us. When you get there to your piece of dirt and you start prepping it to put the house on, what's one of the things you have to do?
Ben, you're going down dangerous territory.
Okay.
if I get technical, I can get long-winded. So I'll try to keep this simple. A traditional single-family lot in southern Arizona needs to be graded to drain at a 1% slope. That moves the water off the lot very fast. And by comparison, we look at the Phoenix marketplace, and they drain their lots off at a 0.5% slope on their lots. So when we're trying to move the water to the street, that means our lots sit about 2.5 feet above our street grade. You can see this, the layman can see this visually just driving through Tucson, driving through Phoenix. Driveways are really steep in Tucson. They're all relatively flat in Phoenix. So that water moves off the lots really fast. And it costs us a lot of money to build those lots to those grades. If instead we could slow that water down, it wouldn't be leaving the project as fast, and it would decrease the cost to build the project. And so my point in the LID meeting was, how about a little incentive? If we try to meet LID standards, could we get something in return, like relief on this 1% grading requirement?
So basically, the costs there, coming from a layman's term, is more dirt, more labor to get that lot to the point where you can build according to code.
Sure.
And also, you have higher engineering costs because you've got water leaving faster, so you have to prepare for that when it hits the wash, if you will. You got to build some sort of
mitigation,
concrete, something there to slow it down.
Yep.
I would imagine.
You also shared something I found fascinating about the city of Austin, where they've got a sort of an incentive program where if you do certain things, they reduce your impact fees by this amount. And eventually you get to a point where your impact fees are waived, which is a huge expense.
Yeah.
But we don't do that in Southern Arizona, apparently. We don't even think about that.
Yeah, the notion of incentives just really hasn't reached this marketplace, and I think that's a huge opportunity for Southern Arizona, is to find a path towards bringing capital in through incentive-based efforts. The Austin point was, build the house to green standards, hit some certain energy efficiency criteria, recycling criteria, and also have an affordability component. This works well on rental property. It's a little tough on for sale property when you start talking about affordability. But if you could hit certain thresholds, you could get your impact fees waived by 50%. If you hit the highest thresholds, you got 100% waiving of impact fees and permit fees. One of the projects I did, I spent about $600,000 to meet that highest threshold of incentives, and in return, I had over $1.2 million of fees waived.
Thank you. I was going to ask that. I'm going to say, is there a trade-off? Now, when the municipalities waive that and they lose that $1.2 million, how do they recapture that? Is Austin in a financial situation where their city council doesn't need that money, conversely, where Tucson, we keep raising impact fees, keep raising permit fees because we need to find other ways to recoup the money that we keep foolishly spending. So there's got to be some government sensibility to where it's affordable and they can pull that off.
I think it's a recognition that it's that one industry alone isn't the only cure to any issue, right?
Well, they whack the heck out of you guys every time they can. That's their first the first place they go. Let's raise the impact fees. Let's raise the permit fees.
Right. So Austin, you know, one of the tech capitals of the country, high volume of people moving in, upwards of 50, 55 people per day moving into the Austin region. So because they have large tech companies that are moving there, one, because it's affordable, and two, because young people like to live there, so that's their target place. So Austin recognized we have to create the housing that these large employers need. So really, they're getting their revenue from the employers instead of the housing market.
Sure. Different path, the same result.
Exactly.
What if you were king for a day, what are some of the other incentives? And one of the things that really sticks in my craw was years ago, the city also passed a gray water recycling ordinance that every new single-family home had to have the plumbing and the stub out to harvest, you know, the washing machine water, that kind of stuff. And the city itself did a study. Nobody is using this. I mean, nobody. But it adds another, what, $500, $600, $700, $800 to the cost of a home. And there again, that's you're passing that on to the buyer. But it's unintended consequence. They're making it more expensive, and it's not achieving what they wanted to achieve. So why don't we get rid of it?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that take rate was something like 0.2%, where houses that were built with the gray water pre-plumbing package a homeowner would then come back and get a gray water application permit. You know, something to build a cistern with. I think it was like 0.1% of all homes built during a 2-year period had a home buyer or homeowner come back and get that permit. So it was, you know, good intentions from the city. You know, recycling gray water sounds good, but the marketplace, the buyer, the consumer doesn't want it. Hmm. They'd rather see that money spent somewhere else. I'd like to use an example. Solar is a really easy one to talk about. Solar is something people want, but they're not ready to pay for it yet.
Okay.
So if you ever got down the path of mandating solar, we're gonna lose customers.
Wow. Okay. Well, there you go, folks. I know you're better educated now about this, and don't forget, make this motivation, get out there and vote. John, thanks for spending your time and sharing your expertise with us. Maybe we can have you back.
Absolutely.
Thanks for this. Thanks. You enjoy that, Sean? Good stuff. Great. There you go, folks. Ben Buehler-Garcia, Sean McCuskey sitting in for Christy Simone. Coming up, we're going to talk about a really cool nonprofit, Lead Guitar. You're not going to want to miss it. Stick around.